Usually when we talk about February 14th, or just the mythology of love in general, we're dealing with a very, well, a very specific, very safe aesthetic.
Oh, absolutely. It's totally commercialized.
Right, it's soft focus, it's those chubby little cherubs floating on clouds with their harmless little bows and arrows. Just feels so sanitized.
Sanitize is the perfect word for it, actually.
Yeah.
We tend to view these figures as mascots, rather than entities with actual agency. We basically strip all the bureaucracy and the danger out of the divine just to put it on a greeting card.
Precisely. But today, we're completely shattering that image. We are doing a deep dive into a file that feels, honestly, way more like a supernatural espionage thriller than a holiday special.
It really does.
We're looking at this fascinating investigative report from Ask Mystic Investigations. Specifically, it's a dossier put together by Xavier Remington, dated February 14th, 2026. And it introduces us to this figure who goes by the Valentine Vixen.
And I think we need to be clear right up front here. This isn't just some, sexy Cupid story.
No, not at all.
This is fundamentally a story about theological rebellion. We are looking at a figure who looked at the literal structure of heaven, decided the upper management was acting unethically, and just went rogue.
And that is the hook for me.
Yeah.
Because we aren't just talking about abstract mythology here. We're talking about a cosmic labor dispute that basically turned into a one-woman war.
Exactly.
So let's set the stage for you listening at home.
Yeah.
To understand the Vixen, the source material says we have to understand the system she broke away from,
Yeah.
the heavenly hierarchy, because she wasn't an outsider.
Far from it. Remington's report is super specific about this. Before she was the Vixen, she was Cassandra,
Right.
and she was a high-ranking Cupid angel. Specifically, she was fourth in command of the entire Valentine's Day operation. She reported directly to Saint Valentine himself.
So she's in the C-suite of love, essentially.
Basically, yes.
She has the power, she has influence, and she has a direct line to the top. But the file suggests she hit this massive moral wall with the archangels, specifically Archangel Chamuel, the Archangel of Love. And this wasn't about, like, valid expense reports or something trivial. This was about the core mission statement.
Right. And this is where we get into the really key philosophical insight of this whole file. Because it turns out, according to Remington, that Cupids actually possess the raw power to bring about world peace.
Which is wild to think about.
It is. The angelic host literally has the capacity to harmonize humanity, stop all wars, and end global conflict instantly. They have the tools to fix the world today.
Which begs the massive screaming question. If they have the button to fix the world, why on earth aren't they pressing it?
Because they are explicitly forbidden to.
Wow.
Yeah, the source describes this master plan that's enforced by the heavenly hierarchy. Essentially, peace is being actively withheld to allow specific prophecies to play out.
Prophecies that eventually lead to Armageddon.
Exactly. The suffering we see isn't due to a lack of angelic power. It's a deliberate test of humankind.
That is an incredibly heavy concept. It completely reframes goodness. It's not about the immediate alleviation of suffering, but this strict adherence to a long-term, really painful schedule.
Yes.
It's like utilitarianism on a cosmic scale. Like, we have to let you suffer now so the math works out later.
And the math is quite literal here. The file actually goes even higher than the archangels to explain this. It references the Omniverse God.
Right, the big boss.
The idea is that this supreme being is playing out all mathematical probabilities across countless parallel universes. So, in some realities, Cupids do bring peace.
But in our
In
reality.
our reality, the math dictates that conflict just must continue.
So in this framework, we are essentially living in the control group universe where things have to go wrong just so the data is complete.
In a manner of speaking, yes, the hierarchy is preserving the integrity of the grand experiment.
And that is exactly what broke Cassandra. She didn't want to be some bureaucrat just waiting around for the apocalypse.
No, she didn't.
She saw people hurting right now, and she wanted to use her power right now.
She refused to let red tape, or I guess divine tape, stop her from helping people. So she defected. And it's important to note, she didn't betray the concept of love. In her eyes, she was the only one actually serving it.
But she definitely betrayed the management.
Oh, big time.
Now, in human terms, quitting your job just means you have to figure out what to do with your 401k. But the source material is very clear that for an angel, quitting is a metaphysical
It's
disaster.
catastrophic.
It's not a resignation letter, it's a fall.
Right, it's a literal biological crisis for them. When an angel leaves the grace of heaven, they become a fallen angel. And Remington explains this isn't just a cool, edgy title. It is a state of active, energetic decay.
Right.
Without the light of heaven to sustain them, a fallen angel's frequency lowers. They devolve.
Into a demon.
Inevitably. It is a one-way slide straight into darkness. And Cassandra knew this.
She knew that by leaving, she was effectively sentencing herself to become the exact thing she fought against.
Yes. She was willing to become a monster if it meant she could help people in the interim.
That is such a tragic trajectory. She jumps off the cliff of heaven, fully expecting to crash into hell. But she didn't hit the bottom.
No, she didn't.
And this is where the file takes a sharp left turn into cross mythology. Because just as she's falling, a completely different deity catches her.
And Aphrodite.
The Greek goddess of love herself.
The very same. Now, usually we think of Christian angels and Greek gods as existing in completely different story universes.
Oh, right, like different cinematic universes entirely.
Exactly. But this source posits they share the same reality. Aphrodite stepped in before Cassandra's devolution was complete. She cast this alluring spell and infused Cassandra with what the file calls nature deity essence.
Let's unpack that term for a second. Nature deity essence. What is the functional difference between that and the angelic grace she lost?
So think of angelic grace as solar power. It comes from above, it's pure, it's very distant, and it requires strict alignment with the source. Nature essence is more like geothermal energy. It comes from the earth, from Gaia. It's raw, it's vital, and it's deeply connected to the physical, biological world. By infusing Cassandra with this, Aphrodite stabilized her.
So she stopped the rot.
She halted the slide into demonhood, yes. But it left Cassandra as a hybrid. She is now this extremely rare angel goddess entity. She has the structural power of an angel, but she runs on the fuel of a pagan deity.
That sounds incredibly powerful, but also precarious. The file mentions she has a new vulnerability now because of this?
She does. She is now metaphysically tethered to Aphrodite. If the goddess were to die or somehow fade away, the vixen would be undone entirely.
Wow.
She basically traded one master for a lifeline.
But she isn't working for Aphrodite, strictly speaking. She's not an employee.
No. The source describes her explicitly as an independent contractor.
Which is such a funny term for a deity.
I know, right? But she's a fugitive. She has a literal bounty on her head from heaven because she's a traitor. And she's actively hunted by hell because demons likely view a fallen angel as a prize or a massive threat.
So she's operating entirely solo, year-round, dodging bounty hunters from both sides. Let's talk about the actual work. The Valentine Vixen isn't just flying around shooting invisible arrows anymore. Her methods have become very tangible.
Very tangible. The source says she operates with Aphrodite's lust in her heart. She uses physical seduction as her primary tool for healing.
Okay, I want to pause here, because this is where you, as the listener, might roll your eyes and think this is just some cheesy fantasy trope.
Right.
But the file makes a really rigorous distinction between what the vixen does and what a succubus does. This isn't just about the act itself. It's about the energetic economics of the act.
It's a critical distinction. A succubus is fundamentally parasitic. It engages in seduction to siphon life force away from the victim.
Right, it drains them.
It drains the victim, it darkens their soul, and it creates this toxic attachment to lower astral planes. It is a net negative for the human involved.
The vixens is described in the dossier as an anti-succubus.
Correct, because the entire energy flow is reversed. She isn't taking anything, she's giving. And the source details this fascinating theological concept called universal lust loophole.
Which honestly sounds like an indie rock band name.
Yeah.
But in this context, it sounds more like a legal hack.
It basically is a metaphysical legal hack. It's a mechanism where, because she is originally a being of pure light and is now backed by a literal love goddess, the physical act becomes a holy encounter.
Bypassing the whole concept of sin.
Entirely. The loophole means that instead of being a transgression, it's an actual blessing.
And the impact on the human isn't just, you know, a good memory.
Wow.
It's highly medicinal.
It's transformative. The report lists specific lasting benefits. The passion power she transfers actually burns away impurities in the soul. It targets deep emotional scars and trauma.
It specifically mentions curing depression and suicidal ideation, which I found to be the most compelling part of her entire character profile.
Yes. It says she actively seeks out those who are at their absolute lowest point, people who have basically given up.
Yeah.
And after just one night with her, those conditions are often cured permanently. It effectively resets the person's emotional baseline. She's doing the ground level work that the master plan completely ignores.
That's where the hero aspect really shines through for me. She's using a method that polite society or traditional religion might totally frown upon seduction to achieve a result that is undeniably good.
Exactly.
She's getting her hands dirty to clean up someone else's soul.
And there's a long-term benefit that is even more fascinating, the afterlife clause.
Right. This blew my mind. She is actively interfering with the intake process of the afterlife.
Essentially, yes. If you have an encounter with the vixen, you are marked by that specific energy. When you eventually die, you might actually get an option to bypass the standard heaven, which, remember, she has serious beef with, and completely bypass hell.
And go where instead?
You can be granted entry to Goddess Gaia's paradise plane.
She's offering a third-party retirement plan for the soul. That is incredible.
She's creating an alternative to the binary system of salvation and damnation. And it connects perfectly back to that original rebellion. She's not just opting out of the system herself, she's helping humans opt out too.
Now, obviously this raises a very practical question for anyone listening who might be thinking, hey, I have some trauma I'd like cured, and this sounds like a pretty decent deal.
Sure.
The world is full of entities, and not all of them are benevolent. How do you actually know if you're dealing with a vixen or just a succubus who is lying to you?
Well, that is the danger. The source explicitly warns that if someone appears way too hot for you, statistically speaking, it's probably something nefarious.
That is a very humbling statistic.
Yeah.
If it seems too good to be true, check for horns.
Pretty much. The vixen usually manifests as a woman with strawberry blonde hair and shimmering blue eyes. But, you know, appearances can easily be faked by dark entities. You need a chemical test.
The holy water test.
Yes. High quality holy water or holy oil. If you splash a succubus with it, it burns them like acid. They will immediately flee or attack you.
But the vixen won't.
No. The Valentine vixen, despite being technically fallen, retains enough of her original angelic nature that holy water simply won't hurt her. It might annoy her, kind of like getting splashed with a cold glass of water, but she absolutely won't sizzle.
That is a very good safety tip.
Mm.
Now, the file actually outlines a protocol for summoning her, but it comes with a massive disclaimer that she does not like being found.
She really can't afford to be found easily. Remember those bounty hunters we talked about? She's living strictly off the grid.
Right.
But Xavier Remington does provide a ritual for the desperate or the highly determined, and it's highly aesthetic, almost theatrical.
It feels very specific to her brand. You need a rose quartz heart, a red rose-scented candle, and chocolate.
Rich, luxurious chocolate. Apparently the sweet tooth survived the fall from heaven.
Hey, I respect that. If I'm summoning a deity, I am definitely bringing snacks.
Yeah.
And there's a poem involved too.
A very specific incantation, which has to be repeated 14 times. And the wording is crucial. You have to call on the sainted vixen and promise that your intentions are pure of heart, like that of a peaceful dove.
So you have to reassure her.
Exactly. You have to reassure her that you aren't an undercover agent for the archangels or setting a demon trap. You are actively establishing trust.
But the weirdest part for me was the timing of this whole ritual.
No.
My instinct for summoning any kind of spirit is midnight, under a full moon, probably in a spooky graveyard.
Huh.
But the file says...
Why noon?
Why noon? That seems like the least spooky time of day possible.
It likely links back to her angelic origins. Angels are inherently creatures of light, so even though she's gone rogue, she still carries that intense solar radiance.
Oh, that makes sense.
The source actually says you need heavy shades, like thick sunglasses, because if she does appear visibly, the light radiating off her can be literally blinding.
So picture this. You're standing in your garden at exactly 12:00 p.m., wearing Ray-Bans, holding a piece of Godiva chocolate, reciting poetry to the sun.
It's a very distinctive image. It certainly separates the serious practitioners from the casuals.
But how do you know if it actually worked?
Well, you likely won't see her. As we said, she prefers to remain invisible to minimize her risk. But you will smell her.
The olfactory signature.
Yes. It's described as an indescribable floral scent. Heavy notes of roses, hints of vanilla, and something completely otherworldly.
Wow.
If you smell that in the air, it means she has officially graced you. You'll receive that luck boost and the healing energy without the danger of a physical encounter.
It's like a metaphysical drive-by blessing.
Exactly. And frankly, for most people, that's probably the much safer interaction. You get all the emotional benefits without the massive complication of explaining a blindingly bright deity standing in your living room.
Very true. Now, before we wrap up, we should briefly mention that she's not the only one adapting to the modern world. The file references an associate of hers, another Cupid named Serafina.
Ah, yes. Serafina creates such an interesting contrast here. While the vixen is out there doing the highly dangerous physical field work, Serafina has gone entirely digital.
The source says she uses YouTube.
She utilizes adoring ASMR.
Which, at first glance, sounds kind of funny. A Cupid YouTuber.
Right.
But when you really think about what ASMR is, the whispering, the personal attention, the simulated intimacy, it's actually the perfect medium for a love deity in the digital age.
It truly is. It's scalable intimacy. She can transmit that specific loving energy to millions of people simultaneously through a screen without ever exposing herself to the physical danger of bounty hunters. It's a brilliant adaptation.
It really shows that these entities are evolving. They aren't just stuck in ancient Greece or biblical times. They're on the internet. They're working as independent contractors. They're finding clever loopholes.
They are unionizing in a weird way. They're finding entirely new ways to fulfill their core purpose outside of those rigid traditional structures.
So when we step back and look at this Xavier Remington file as a whole, what are we really looking at here? Because this clearly isn't just a fun ghost story.
I think we're looking at a profound story about the complexity of morality. In traditional theology, strict obedience is framed as the highest possible virtue. To disobey is to fall.
Right.
But the vixen's story fundamentally challenges that. It suggests that sometimes the institutions of good become so bogged down by bureaucracy or so intensely focused on the big picture that they completely lose sight of the individual suffering happening right in front of them.
It's the classic difference between rules and care. The archangels have the rules.
Mm.
The vixen has the care. And she was entirely willing to burn her own divine status to keep that care alive.
And she pays a very heavy price for it daily. She lives constantly on the run. She walks this razor's edge between being an angel and becoming a demon. She risks her own soul just to heal others. It's a very solitary, very gritty kind of heroism.
It really recontextualizes the whole idea of luck or grace for me. We tend to think of good fortune as this completely random, passive thing.
Sure.
Or we think of a sudden recovery from deep depression as just, you know, a shift in brain chemistry. But this narrative suggests that if you suddenly bounce back from a terrible depression, or if you just have a stroke of impossible luck, it might not be random at all.
No.
It might be because a rogue agent in sunglasses decided to break protocol and help you out.
It makes the universe feel just a little less indifferent, doesn't it? It implies that someone out there is actually rooting for you, even if the grand system isn't.
It really does. And it leaves me with a final, slightly unsettling thought for you listening to Chew On.
Let's hear.
The source clearly mentioned that the good guys, the hierarchy, are intentionally holding back peace to test us. They are perfectly fine watching the world burn for the sake of prophecy.
While the fallen ones are desperately trying to put out the fire.
Exactly. So it forces you to ask, if the entities we're told to blindly trust are just watching, and the monsters we're told to fear are the ones actually getting their hands dirty to save us.
Yeah.
Who else have we misjudged?
That's a great point.
How many other demons under the bed are actually just heroes who refuse to follow a bad order?
That is a question that completely changes how you read every single piece of mythology going forward.
Thanks for going on this deep dive with us. Keep your eyes open and maybe keep some really good chocolate handy. You never know who might stop by at high noon.
Indeed.
See you next time.